more how the equipment works, how to make it work better. Antennas, transmission lines, transmitters, receivers, propagation. The subjects that are discussed on the TechNet are essentially any subject of interest to serious radio amateurs. College, and maybe we'll hear from a few people who attended that as to what they saw. Something like 150 vendors were there. Light equipment. Let me drop. Rich, K2UPS, and I came close to going to it, but because of the mix-up, it didn't happen. The main subjects of discussion for the TechNet don't have to be super technical. There are times when we get some very simple questions. Don't be afraid to ask a so-called simple question. A dumb question, a simple question, sometimes the one most deserving of an answer. We don't have that snooty attitude that, hey, it doesn't come up to our to the level of our liking, if you know what I mean. So don't worry about that. This will be Technical Net number 1646 of the series that began in September of 1982. 34 and a fraction years ago. You'll also be hearing tonight Space Report number 246 from Paul WS2N. And NASA's been doing some interesting things, which you'll be hearing about. A person signs into the TechNet by giving us your call letters, your name, and the word yes, which means you do have a question or a comment for the net. Need not sign in just because you're listening. After 34 years and thousands of TechNets, thousands of hours, by now we believe somebody is listening. It doesn't have to be proven anymore. So, at this time, give me your call letters and your name. Try to remember to wait for the four beeps in between transmissions so we don't time out the machine. K2RIW listening for check-in.
And here we go with a question and a comment.
Rich recognized. Anyone else?
WH1YY Joe, yes.
Okay, we got Rich, Joe. Anyone else to check into the TechNet? Give me your call letters and name right now. In the background, I'm hearing another TechNet from outside of the area. I'm amazed. Or another net of some kind. One last call. Anyone to check in because you do have a question or a comment for the net? Or maybe you would like to tell us what you saw at the Northeast Astronomy Forum. Give me a call letter and name right now. K2RIW listening.
KC2MDP, Steve, and yes.
A late check-in named Steve. Okay, Steve, thank you. And one more call. Someone to check in to the TechNet. Give me your call letters and name right now.
Hey, Stewie Teddy.
Okay. Eric, let's see. You rarely ask us questions. You most always supply the answers. Is this going to be an answer section or a real question session that you're going to have, Eric? Go ahead.
Actually, a couple things. I have something that you should be able to answer and actually help me understand something a little bit. And, you know, I've got a whole bunch of stuff that we can talk about that I sent you.
They sure did. That ITER, I think it is. Boy, what a big machine that is. Wow. One last call. Anyone to check into the TechNet? Give me a call letters and name right now.
This is NY2HF, Dennis.
Okay, we got Dennis. And he possibly went to the Northeast Astronomy Forum. All right, first guy on our list was Rich, N2EO, the redhead Rich, K2RAW.
Okay, Dick, first of all, I'll say good evening to all on the TechNet. And Dick, I have a comment and a question. originally bought a Kinect Systems CS-800. It's a TMR radio. I called up Kinect Systems to find out if they knew of an aftermarket microphone, a desk mic, instead of a hand mic. And we had a reset. Gentleman, Kinect Systems says he thought that a Kenwood desk mic was wired the same way and would work on the Kinect Systems. But, you know, he said, check it out. And my comment on that is, on an icon, D-Star FM radio. Years ago, I plugged in a Heil Systems microphone instead of the original icon. It worked perfectly. But when I went back to the icon mic, try it. It wouldn't work at all. Something got damaged in the PTT circuit. I tried to fix it, but at that time, I got ill. I needed emergency surgery on my spine. And then Patty moved because I was in the hospital. So she had to move herself. And I think the radio just got blown out. It was in pieces. So my warning to people is, check it out first before you plug in some other microphone, which is what I'm doing now. Does anybody know for sure if the Kenwood mic, in particular an MC60, will work on the Kinect system? With no damage, M2EO.
Okay, I hope we have some DMR experts available tonight. The Kinect System DMR radio. Do you guys believe it is compatible with the Kenwood MC60 microphone? Are they really wired the same? Anybody got any information on that? Give me a call at us right now. K2RIW, TechNet listening.
Hey, to you, Jack.
Go ahead, Eric. You got it.
No, this is the website. They have the schematics for the radio. Since they are actually selling them directly to hams, they were courteous enough to put the schematics on the website.
Okay, now who put the schematic on the website? Is it Kenwood with the MC60? Or is it Kinect Systems with the DMR radio? ODU, Eric?
The Kinect Systems has a schematic on their website. And, of course, if you go to do a Google search for Kenwood, you'll find a schematic for the Kenwood radio.
Okay, so by comparing those schematics and the connector pin numbers, connector type, we should be able to find out if they're compatible. What's your guess as to what can possibly go wrong to damage a microphone? My first guess is that if there was a miswiring in such a way that the push-to-talk voltage gets applied to the hot lead of the microphone, and if it's a certain kind of a delicate microphone, I guess there's a slim chance the microphone element could be damaged. Does that sound reasonable, Eric? KE2EJ, K2LIW.
Well, radio's a little different today. Many radios will have a pair of data lines. Some, besides having the push-to-talk, which will be, a pull-up resistor, probably something like, 10K or 1K. So that really wouldn't be a source of problems. But many of today's radios, including the commercial radios, have a tendency to provide 12 volts, real 12 volts at a couple hundred mils to run stuff in the microphone. So that's where you got to watch it.
Okay, that makes sense. So it looks like, Rich, the information you're looking for is available by way of Kinect System schematics and Kenwood. And I'm sure there's a way to find out the schematic for the MC60 microphone from Kenwood. KE2EJ, I'm not sure. N2EO, K2LIW, Greg Rich.
Greg, Kenwood, you can have schematics on the microphones.
Okay, Dick. It was not the microphone I've got damaged. It was the push-to-talk circuit in the radio, the ICOM radio. So I don't want to go through that again.
Okay, good luck with that operation, Eric. Rich, by way of those schematics, I think you'll find out what's going on there. Next person on our list was Joe, W-2-R-Y-Y. Go right ahead, Joe.
It turns on the line, make sure no feedback here. Okay. I got two different subjects. Can you talk about either one? Antenna systems related to talking to or receiving stuff from the moon. Or something I just saw in QS. It's QRZ, the website, I think that's what it's called, about two different new bands in the U.S., at 630 meters and 2200 meters. Those subjects I'd like to talk about. Back to you. The low band one has some another article possibly related to it.
Now, your first question is on the subject of receiving signals from the moon. And I wonder, are you talking about moon bounce, ham radio, or if somebody has put a beacon on the moon, or some other transmitter like the ALSEP packages? I don't know if they're still operational, but for quite a number of years, people were using the weak signal on 2.3 gigahertz from the Apollo Lunar Surface Experimental packages as a standard way of measuring sensitivity of their ground station receiving equipment. So, over to you for clarification of that moon bounce question, Rich. I mean, Joe. W-2-R-Y-Y, K-2-R-I-W.
Okay. More to do with receiving stuff from either moon bounce or coming or stuff being emitted there, like when you were involved in listening to stuff directly. Using the path loss calculation formula, at 2300 megahertz and 240,000 miles, you come up with an answer of something like 211.4 decibels of path loss. Now, in a case of you receiving this stuff directly from the moon or from an orbiting spacecraft around the moon, what kind of energy was being produced from that point in space and at what bandwidth? Do you have that answer?
Okay. Normally, when people talk about moon bounce, they talk about the round trip distance. In other words, when you transmit a signal in order to do moon bounce, a certain percentage of it, because the moon is only a half a degree wide, only a certain percentage of the signal you transmit with your, let me pick a number, 10 degree wide antenna, only a certain percentage of it hits the moon. And of the energy that hits the moon, only a certain percentage of it comes reflecting back to Earth. So the round trip path loss for a moon bounce guy on 432 is something like 263 dB, as I remember. One-way path loss, you calculated 211, sounds right. Now, since you know you've got 211 dB of free space loss from moon to Earth or Earth to moon, let me drop this. And if your receiver had a 0 dB noise figure, it's an easy way to start discussing it, and if it had a 10 kilohertz bandwidth, minus 114 dBm per megacycle is the amount of noise of a resistor at room temperature, and minus 114, because a 10 kilohertz bandwidth is 100 to 1 smaller than 1 megacycle, minus 114 becomes 124, 134. Minus 134 dBm is the amount of noise power you'll get at 0 dB of noise figure. And then you subtract from that what is your real noise figure in dBs and what signal-to-noise ratio you want. And the bottom line is maybe you can receive a signal of minus 120. So if you can receive a signal of minus 120 dBm and the path loss is only 211, how many watts must you transmit in order to be able to hear the signal? And so The first thing a person does is to convert watts into milliwatts because the path loss and the receiver sensitivity is usually calculated in dBm, dB with reference to a milliwatt. And there's a 30 dB difference between a watt and a milliwatt. So you go through all the numbers, and let me drop. If your transmitter was putting out 1 watt, for instance, that's a transmitter power of plus 30 dBm. That's plus 0 dBw, but plus 30 dBm. If the antenna doing the transmitting on the moon had 10 dB of gain, then that would be 30 plus 10, or it would be plus 40 dBm of transmit power. So you take plus 40 dBm, in your case, subtract 211 from it, and now you know the signal strength that's going to be received on the ground with a 0 dB receiving antenna. And then your real receiving antenna is probably going to have 20 dB of gain, so it's going to make that signal 20 dB stronger. So the combination of knowing the transmit power, knowing the transmit antenna gain on the moon, knowing the free space loss, knowing the antenna gain on the ground, you add up those plus and minus numbers, and you come out with a signal strength of dBm. And now you worry about whether or not your receiver will be able to receive that. Depending on how pure the signal is, if it was a pure CW tone, the next question is, what's the weakest signal you can listen to? And if the tone is steady enough in frequency, and if your receiver is steady enough in frequency, you can make the receiver bandwidth more and more narrow, and you can pick up more and more signal. Let me drop. I said more and more signal. I really mean weaker and weaker signal. That's exactly what's going on with Voyager. Voyager is out there 12 billion miles away, three times the distance to Pluto, something like 120 or 130 astronomical units. It's transmitting 10 watts of power with something like 30 or 40 dB of antenna gain. And the free space loss from that thing back to the ground is 315 dB, one way. And so that signal coming down is so weak that even with a 240-foot dish at Goldstone, they have to make the receiver bandwidth 50 hertz. So with a 50 hertz bandwidth, which means they're only getting data at roughly 50 bits per second, I'm rounding up the numbers here, they're getting a nice, clean signal by their standards, as long as they're willing to transmit the data slow enough. So if anyone ever asks what's the weakest signal that can be received with a radio receiver, there is no exact answer. You can always make the bandwidth a little bit more narrow on the receiver. You can make the integration period a little bit longer. You can slow the data down. There's all kinds of ways. So I think you see the process here, Joe. You've already become a little bit familiar with that formula. Let me drop it. When it comes to how strong a signal should you be able to get on this communication circuit, in the case of a space circuit, which is only free space, there's no trees in the way, no earth curvature, and so on, the very handy formula is loss in dB of free space is 36.6 plus 20 times the log of frequency in megahertz plus 20 times the log of the distance in miles. And by the way, you can change that 36.6 number out in front to some other number if you want the raw ingredients going in not to be megahertz but gigahertz in frequency, or if you want the distance to be kilometers or feet instead of miles. And so there's ways you can force that formula to work with your favorite set of units, but it's a nice, simple formula that's not so well published, I'm kind of amazed. And if you're using the one that I gave you, 36.6, 20 log F megahertz plus 20 log D miles, bear in mind that the miles don't have to be exactly a mile. It can be 0.01 mile, if you know what I mean, if you want to use 52 feet, and the formula will work. And so the fact that you're using a very small fraction of a mile, the dBs are very nice and friendly. They'll make it all come out right. Let me drop. So with the familiarity with that formula, there's a lot of situations in which you can figure out, hey, I've only got a 10 milliwatt transmitter. It's going into a dipole on 2 meters on the top of my building. Will I be able to hear it with another dipole on 2 meters 5 miles away if I have a line of sight path with that formula, you can find out pretty fast whether or not you stand a chance. It's amazing how many guys with radio experience, years and years, cannot answer that relatively simple sounding question. A known amount of power transmitting from this antenna, a known number of miles at this number of megahertz, will I be able to receive the signal on the other end? Will it be above threshold? How strong will the signal be? And so, by way of that formula, quite a few people who didn't previously know how to calculate that circuit now know how. Let's see what other information you might require on this one, Joe. W-H-2-R-Y-Y, T-2-R-I-W in the TechNet.
No other information. It's just interesting to talk about it because it becomes rather fascinating when you start adding up, adding and subtracting all the differences and so forth, power levels and so forth, and what you add up, actually how to realize what you actually get and received energy coming back from something so far away. You have to do some pretty fancy stuff to be able to receive it and decode the information on it properly. Now, do you want to do any talking about these? I don't know if you know about these other probably a different type of question. Actually, I think I read this off QRZ. Two new bands opened up in the U.S., 630 meters and 2,200 meters. Now, that must take some techniques to make stuff work down there. What do you have to say about that?
I'm going to go back to the previous one for a couple of minutes. Many a radio amateur becomes quite pleased if in the CW mode he's able to hear a tone in the noise from the carrier of a piece of electronics that's sitting either on the moon, or it's a piece of NASA electronics, a spacecraft that's on the way to Mars or on the way to Venus. A number of amateurs have considered their definition of success that they know what frequency was transmitted, they know how many watts, they know roughly where the satellite is, they know it's going toward Mars, it's going toward Venus. They're able to do a calculation as to what angle it's going to be from their backyard at this instant of time. They aim their dish in that direction. And if they can hear a weak tone in the noise, they say, aha, I'm hearing to that spacecraft. And so when it comes to listening to a weak tone in the noise, the limited bandwidth in that situation is the bandwidth between your ears. A human hearing system listening for a tone in the noise is something like a 50 hertz noise equivalent bandwidth. So even though you might be listening with an IF strip that has a bandwidth, the audio and the IF strip might have a bandwidth of 5 kilohertz. The magic about the human hearing system is that it can narrow itself down when it knows to listen for, let's say, an 800 hertz tone. You would think that you would have to narrow the receiver itself. Well, not necessarily. If you did an experiment where you had a receiver that's 100 hertz wide and a human set of ears are listening for a weak tone in the noise, let me drop this. So the receiver is 100 hertz wide, and you're hearing the tone in the noise, and then you flip over to making the receiver 2 kilohertz wide, and you do the exact same experiment, making no other changes. The human hearing system, almost a trained ear, has almost no difference. It'll still hear that tone in the noise because your hearing can narrow itself up, so to speak. The great processing that goes on between that cochlear and the brain. So just hearing the tone in the noise, to many an amateur, has been the definition of success. Whether or not the real data being sent in the downlink from the satellite itself, whether or not they were able to demodulate that data. And in most amateur situations, they didn't even seek to do that. So when you plug in the number of 50 hertz of bandwidth and calculate sensitivity, and by the way, you saw what I was doing before. Noise of a 50 ohm resistor, which is a good reference point, minus 114 dBm per megahertz of bandwidth. Make the bandwidth 1 kilohertz instead of 1 megahertz, minus 114 becomes minus 144, because you get 30 dB more sensitivity when you change the bandwidth of the receiver by a 1,000-to-1 ratio, as I did in that example. So with those two rules of thumb, how much noise power do you get out of a resistor? And by the way, that's a good starting point for a 0 dB noise figure at room temperature. Let me drop this. If you've got a dish aimed at a cold portion of the sky, not toward the sun, and if you've got a receiver with a noise figure of 1 dB or a half a dB, your numbers become a lot more friendly. You can end up with the noise power in that receiver bandwidth at the RF front end can be numbers like minus 120, minus 130 dBm of noise power because of the fact that the sky is cold. It's not running at room temperature. A good antenna with good side lobe control and back lobe control aimed at a cold portion of the sky is hearing very little noise. And therefore, when you go from a 3 dB noise figure to a half dB noise figure, you think you're going to make 2.5 dB of improvement in sensitivity. Well, when you get into cryogenic circuits, you have to calculate things in degrees Kelvin, not in decibels, because they behave differently on a terrestrial and a extraterrestrial. Yeah, when it comes to a space circuit, the noise of the background that was measured by the WMAP satellite, for instance, 3 degrees Kelvin, is what the space noise really is. So you can end up with a hell of a lot more sensitivity. To B2RYY for any more clarification. And I don't have any information on that other subject, Joe, sorry to say. To B2RYY, T2RW, the TechNet.
Okay, really good, Tech. There's nothing further in from the other one, like right below where they announced these two new bands. They also had something that the guy had a complaint with. The FCC actually acted on it. And it was a company called SolarCity making this device called a load balancing device called an optimizer, and the thing was producing an S9 signal at this guy's house, two houses away from this structure. And they even found out when they disconnect the solar cells, the thing is still emitting noise. So how's that? A lot of things can generate noise out there. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, some of these solar voltaic systems that are installed on people's houses, you have to recognize the fact that the power voltage coming out of your solar voltaics is a DC voltage, and to convert that, to step it up, step it down in voltage, and to convert it into 60 cycle real power that you can use, you're using some switching electronics in many cases, and that switching electronics, what you're describing is the fact that it can create a lot of electromagnetic interference. So the average person is very tolerant of that electromagnetic interference if he's got a cable TV system that's well shielded with coaxial cable connectors that are well installed. There can be an awful lot of noise coming out of the electronics on his roof, and he doesn't know it. The ham radio operator next door with sensitive state-of-the-art equipment with an antenna that's looking at the real world, not looking at the inside of the coax cable, like from a cable TV system. That's a very different environment, and he can be easily disturbed. And the next question the ham is going to ask is, hey, is that piece of electronics meeting the standards for what is allowed for undesired emissions? And can it be fixed? So I think we're going to be getting more and more of that as more people put solar voltaics on their roof. Let's see. We'll open up one question here for a minute. When it comes to the new bands at 630 and 2,200 bandwidth and that wavelength, if anybody on frequency has got any information on that new subject that the ARRL and QST and FCC is negotiating or discussing, anybody got any further information on that, give me a call. That is right now. T2IW and the TechNet.
Comment on SolarCity. First, WSOS. Good evening, Dick.
Repeater, timeout.
Go right ahead with your SolarCity information, Paul. WS2N, T2RIW.
Nothing technical about what we're talking about, but SolarCity is owned or operated by Elon Musk, which we talk about a lot here. Same guy that owns SpaceX and Tesla Motors, but he SolarCity is a massive company, and you know, he's behind that as well. So, I'm surprised there's problems coming out of that equipment. If anybody can fix it, his group should be able to to address that. Back to you, Dick.
Okay, thank you, Paul. And yeah, that guy Musk, he's got some great capabilities. I think we're going to go over to the next person on our list now, Steve. KC2MVP, K2RW, what would you like to talk about tonight, Steve?
Good evening, Dick. Good evening to the rest of the net. Dick, I got a question basically about feed line. This is what I did, and I'll explain what I'm going to do, and then I'll explain my concerns. Basically, I had to change my antenna route the 2 meter, 70 centimeter water got in it. So basically, I got a brand new antenna. It's temped out in the backyard. I had some feed line, hard line, I should say, you know, 70 ohm, I think it's 7/8 hard line. It's about, I'd say, probably 40, 50 feet. And right now I have it going to probably about 40 feet of, oh boy, what is that stuff now? LMR 400. It works fine, everything's great. The SWR is probably about 1.8. My only concern is I'm eventually going to be moving the antenna closer to the house, the original location. I'm going to shorten the LMR 400 probably to about 20 feet. And the only reason I'm asking this question is this particular radio starts getting pretty persnickety once the SWR goes above 2. Now, shortening the LMR 400, is that going to raise the SWR? Is it going to lower? Is it going to make it the same? And what can I do, being this is a dual band? I mean, I know how to, tune the single. What would I have to do to bring the SWR to a tolerable level for a dual band? Back to you.
A little bit of what you're asking, the answer is it depends. But in general, since your transmitter is 50 ohms and since the LMR 400 is 50 ohms, I am guessing the first piece of cable coming out of your transmitter is the LMR 400. You go a certain distance with it, and then you're hitting the 70 ohm hard line. That's my guess. Before I proceed, let's find out which piece of cable is first, which piece of cable is second. It's the LMR 400 you're changing the length of, but it's the 70 ohm hard line. The first piece of cable or the last piece of cable going to the antenna? That's question number one. Question number two, the kind of cable that got water in it, you got a lot of damage. I'm kind of curious what kind of cable was that. KC2MDP, K2LIW.
Okay, yeah, very good, Dick. Yeah, you're correct in your assumption. Yeah, the hard line is going from the antenna. Basically, it's going to go from the antenna right into the house as far as possibly can get to the radio. Then from there, I figured I'd use the LMR 400 from the hard line to the radio itself. I had a 9913, and it's one of those diamond, you know, the fiberglass radome type antennas. And, you know, my guess was that 9913, I know that stuff is pretty bad for water. I cut back the 9913. I temped that. The SWR was still 4 on the antenna. So what I think happens, it looks like the top of the antenna, the fiberglass split and water was getting in there. Back to you.
Yeah, so-called 9913 comes in a couple of different forms. In the very beginning, it was almost an air dielectric, just a little bit of a spiral wound piece of plastic trying to hold the semiconductor in the right place. And because that cable would easily breathe between a hot and a cold day, and it was sucking in water, the later versions of 9913 had some kind of a foil underneath the braid, which makes it a lot more hermetically sealed. And so there are kinds of 9913 where water getting in is not quite as bad. Although, I guess if you had a failure in the antenna, there's ways the antenna itself can force in water. Now, getting back to your particular question, let me drop it. Assuming your antenna is being fed directly with the hard line. The hard line is 70 ohms. 70 ohms going into your antenna creates a certain amount of standing wave ratio. That interface of 70 into 50, I forget what the exact number is, but you divide 50 into 70, and I guess it's something like a 1.3 or 1.4 standing wave ratio right at that interface. If the antenna was a pure 50 ohm antenna, very few antennas are. but you're getting a slight interface there. In your particular case, your hard line is a fixed length. You're not changing it. So the input end of the hard line, at the shack end, has some particular crazy impedance of the interface of the real impedance of the antenna through some number of wavelengths of 70 ohm hard line. So there's some real impedance at the shack end of the 70 ohms. You're now going to be feeding that with a 50 ohm length of LMR 400. Changing the length of the LMR 400, assuming now you don't have any problems with RF energy crawling on the outside of the coax, everything is properly shielded or bound, if you know what I mean. The length of the LMR 400, assuming it was lossless, will have no effect on standing wave ratio. You've got a 50 ohm transmitter, 50 ohm LMR 400, hitting an interface of the so-called 70 ohm cable with whatever crazy impedance it has, reflected all the way back down to the shack. So LMR 400 length, no change in standing wave ratio. Assuming the LMR 400 is lossless, if you allow the LMR 400 to slowly get longer and longer, your input as well will get better and better because of the loss of the LMR 400. But there's only one real, in your variable condition here of changing the length of the LMR 400 inside the shack, that length is not a Viswa creating device.
Repeater, timeout.
It's not adding a complication to the Viswa calculation, assuming there's no RF energy on the outside of the coax. Now, you talk to the guys on 20 meters on a Saturday afternoon, you'll find a zillion guys who say that when I change the length of my transmission line, the standing wave ratio went up or went down, and therefore they know that there's some magic length of transmission line that's going to make the standing wave ratio either go to a minimum or disappear. And they say, I really measured it. It's real. Well, if they've got some RF energy falling on, crawling down the outside of the coax because they didn't have the right kind of a balance at the antenna, they didn't realize the length of the transmission line is now part of the resonant circuit of the antenna. And in that case, when you change the length of the transmission line, you're changing the tuning of the antenna, and yes, the Viswa goes up and down. And so, therefore, these guys come up with this theory that the length of the transmission line changes the Viswa. If it's a pure shielded circuit, the answer is no. Viswa represents a certain reflected power ratio, and just because you've made the transmission longer or shorter, that's not going to change that reflected power ratio. Therefore, the Viswa is not going to change. So you can see there's a yes and a no to that. I'm assuming you don't have RF on the coax, therefore make that length of the LMR 400 anything you want to. Now, there's ways you can find out what is giving you the Viswa that you're seeing, and there's ways of correcting it. And so that's another whole subject you might want to discuss. KC2, MDP, K2IW, go ahead, Steve.
Exactly, Dick. Yeah, I'm not worried about the, it's probably about 1.8. Like I said, this radio starts dropping back in power with 2. So I figure maybe, with a little bit of age, a little bit of rain, if it starts climbing up there, it's going to start folding the power back on my radio. And yeah, I was just curious, probably being it's a dual band radio, how would I go about, let's say bringing the SWR, doesn't have to be perfect, but bringing it back to a tolerable level for this radio. Back to you, Dick.
Now, when it comes to correcting standing wave ratio, there's a zillion ways of doing it. The elegant way is do it right at the antenna itself. Your particular antenna, there's ways you can measure it and find out what it's doing at your favorite frequency. An antenna analyzer, a standing wave ratio bridge, a vector network analyzer, and so on. And you can correct it right at the antenna. And you'd like to keep using the 70 ohm cable. You could, if you want to, do some tinkering with the antenna to make the antenna become a 70 ohm load, even though it was designed for 50. That's nowhere near as difficult as you think. If, for instance, your antenna was a Yagi-like antenna and had a dipole-driven element, and the dipole is set up for 50 ohm impedance, and you want to make the driven element of your dipole that's inside of your Yagi 70 ohms, you'd be amazed how easy that is to do. There's all kinds of ways you can do tinkering by way of the Brown and Woodward curves that you can find on those two websites, the amateurradio.tv or limartechnet.com. By way of the Brown and Woodward curves, you'll find that by... Let me drop... By simply lengthening the dipole, the resistive component of impedance will go up. And now by using a kind of a gimmicking capacitor, you'll get rid of the reactive component that's left over. By the way, when you do that kind of tuning, one of the things that I forgot to mention last week when we were discussing this with Joe, is that when you do that kind of tuning, there's always some interaction. Making the dipole longer makes the impedance go up, but gives you some reactance. Correcting the reactance makes the apparent length change a little bit. There's some interaction between the two. So you have to go back and forth between length, resistance, and tuning capacitor, so to speak. The piece of copper foil, in my example, you're putting at the end of the dipole in order to get rid of the reactance. But once you accept the fact, there's going to be some interaction. There's going to be more than one step. You can make the exact impedance of the dipole, for instance, in the middle of the Yagi, you can make it any impedance you want. And by way of that article by K2LIW that you'll find on either of those websites, he tells you how to do it. So you can correct the standing wave ratio right at the antenna and make it 70 ohms if you want to. Let me drop it. That's the elegant approach. The next step of that is to use some kind of a antenna tuner. And what would an antenna tuner look like on a 70-ohm cable? And by the way, if you're willing to put the 70-ohm, if you're willing to put your antenna tuner, which is designed for 50 ohms, and you want to connect it to a 70-ohm cable, that's not a sacrilegious thing to do. I mean, an antenna tuner, in theory, can take any impedance, no matter where it came from, whether it came from open wire transmission line, whether it came from 70-ohm hard line, whether it came from a piece of 50-ohm coax that had been mistreated in some way, it doesn't give a darn what the actual device is on the output of the antenna tuner. So you can put the antenna tuner between the two pieces of cable, for instance, or you can put the antenna tuner at the input end of your LMR 400 and then therefore make the transmitter happy. That's probably the easiest approach. If you had an antenna tuner and you put it right at the shack end of the LMR 400, you can make everything hunky-dory at each one of those frequencies, one step at a time. So there's lots of ways of doing it. There's all kinds of ways. You can put a T-connector in there with a stub, and at each of your favorite frequencies, make the standing wave ratio go away. And that's another one of these elegant approaches. So correcting standing wave ratio, there's a large number of ways to go. And so the problem is there's so many ways to go with that one, Steve. You have to decide which one you like, which one you understand, which one you're willing to do. KC2MDP, K2IW in the TechNet.
Okay, yes, very Dick. Good, Dick. Yes, I thought about all of these. The only thing that basically throwing me off is it's being dual band. As far as, you know, I guess I'd have to make two different stubs and everything like that. And as far as, yeah, making the antenna length shorter or longer, that sort of scared me a little bit, too, being it's one of those, you know, collinear antennas. Basically, you know, 2 meters, 70 centimeters, and the thing's 22 feet long. Does that theory hold true for that style antenna if I were to, you know, the tip of it, make it a little bit longer, make it a little bit shorter to, you know, change your impedance back to you?
Does that work as a tuning technique? Absolutely. Your world, though, is a little bit more complicated because it's a dual band antenna. Murphy's Law sort of dictates that whenever you change the tuning on one band, it's going to get worse on the other. When you make an improvement on one, it's going to get worse on the other. And could you use stubs and various tuning devices to make the standing wave ratio disappear on both bands simultaneously? Answer is absolutely yes. You're not violating any laws of physics. That's the good news. The bad news, actually carrying it out, is a little bit more complicated, without a doubt. Because at first, whatever you do to one band, in some cases, it's going to worsen the other band. But there are ways of putting the stub in just the right spot so that it corrects both bands simultaneously. That can be done. Once you've got an antenna analyzer and you really know the impedance at, say, for instance, the shack end of the 70-ohm hard line, if you really know the impedance of each antenna on your favorite frequency of each of those bands, I should say each of those frequencies, if you really know the impedance, then with that raw information, there's a way you can derive a solution that solves both of them simultaneously. But if you're willing to put an antenna tuner there, and the antenna tuner covers those bands, I see the problem now. There are very few antenna tuners you can buy that cover 2 meters and 450, if that's the two bands we're talking about. So It takes amateur-like approach to create the equivalent of an antenna tuner. There's nothing wrong with an antenna tuner on 2 meters and 450. Just that I'm not sure there are very many commercial products that do that. I mean, most people buy an antenna tuner for 80 to 10 meters, maybe 6 meters. They tend not to use an antenna tuner above that for no good reason. It's just a matter of what people have gotten used to. Over to you, Steve, K2LIW.
Yes, you're absolutely correct. I was thinking yes. I got a couple old MFJ antenna tuners around here. And correct me if I'm wrong, but my theory is if it's, changing impedance and everything else, reactance, inductance, all that stuff on 10 through 80, wouldn't it do the same exact thing on 2 meter and 440? Couldn't I just use a regular, basic HF antenna tuner on 2 meter and 440? Back to you.
In theory, yes, but there's a bit of a problem. The way they design the maximum minimum capacitance and the size of the inductor in an antenna tuner that's designed for 80 through 10, they're already stretching the laws of physics in order to make it work over all five of those bands, 80, 40, 20, 15, and 10, for instance. They're pushing their luck just to make it work across all of those. If you now try to take a conventional design antenna tuner and you would like it to work from 160 meters up to 450, I won't say it's impossible, but that would be an extremely difficult design. You're better off using a separate device, antenna tuner-like device, to cover your VHF, UHF frequencies. And there's various ways you can homebrew that. And a homebrew antenna tuner on the VHF frequencies is, in theory, quite a bit easier. The components get a lot smaller, the amount of box size you need, and so on. So there's nothing wrong with you and I designing an antenna tuner that works on 2 and 450. The exact same theory works. The size of the components will be quite different. I think there's somebody that wanted to sign in with a piece of information for us. Who was that? K2LIW listening.
KTVS mobile.
Now, there's a guy who's going through all kinds of frequencies with antenna tuners. Go right ahead, Rich, and... I've already mentioned the fact that you and I came close to going to the Northeast Astronomy Forum if I hadn't made a mistake. KTUPS, mobile. I'm going to guess you're in Pennsylvania or Ohio. You got it, Rich, K2LIW in the TechNet.
We're in Ohio, getting ready to cross into West Virginia. The comment, I was going to mention that the MFJ makes a tuner, but the other station already knew that. But in addition to changing the length of that dual band based antenna, I think you said it was 22 feet long, whatever, most of those also have three or four short radials sticking out from the base at the T point. Could he not also adjust the impedance by adjusting the angle of those or the droop?
Yeah, that's a pretty good guess, though, Rich. And there's a sort of a yes and a no to that. When it comes to changing the length of the radiator to make it tune correctly, that's the direct approach. When you change the angle, length, the spacing, or whatever of the radials, can you do tuning with that? Absolutely. But now let's think about what's going on. If, for instance, the radiator itself was, let me pick a number, 30 ohms capacitor reactance, and now you want to correct that by making the ground plane radials act like 30 ohms of inductive reactance. By adjusting the tilt and length of those radials, can you do that? Absolutely. But now what you've done, by making your ground plane radials reactive, you're now forcing RF energy at the point where the transmission line connects to the base of the antenna. You've made your ground plane hot, and therefore to some degree, your transmission line, the outer conductor of your transmission line, is now going to have RF energy on it. Maybe I'm worrying you too much, and maybe for the first few degrees of tuning, the amount of RF energy on the coax outside shield is not going to be so great, and it's not a big problem. But making the ground plane the counterpoise, making the ground plane radials radio hot, is what you're doing when you're using them as a tuning device. When the ground plane radials are really working correctly, they are electronically a quarter wavelength long. The open end of each one of those is an infinite impedance,
quarter wave away, you get a short circuit. So the ground plane radios, when they are tuned correctly, present a RF short circuit at the base of the antenna. You start making that ground plane reactive, and it's not a short circuit anymore, and you're forcing RF energy on the coax. So it's not a showstopper, but it's something to be a little bit concerned with. I wonder if that makes some sense, Rich. KQUPS, KQLIW in the tech net.
Yes, it does, Dick. I was just thinking how, like, when we make, I think just about everybody has made a quarter wave ground plane for 2 meters or 4-4 to use like an SO239 connector. And I know there the four radios you put on are drooping down to make it a better match for 50 ohm coax as opposed to if they were straight out parallel with the ground. So I just figured maybe adjusting that angle might help them match that. But what you said makes a lot of sense.
Okay, I'm glad you brought that up, Rich. Those ground plane radials on a 2 meter quarter wave radiator, for instance, that you might use on 2 meters where the base is an SO239 connector, you have something like a 19 inch piece of wire coming off the center conductor, and you got these four wires coming off the four screw holes of the TL259 as the ground plane radials. When you tune those, when you tilt those radios down, if you tilted them down all the way, you now would really have a center fed dipole, and it would have a 70 ohm impedance. If you start tuning the ground plane radios up, you'll start getting lower than 50 ohms. So what you're literally doing, it doesn't make common sense, but what you're literally doing when you tilt those ground plane radios, you're changing the apparent impedance of the radiator itself. You're not necessarily making the ground plane hot. You're using the fact that you're sliding from either a pure dipole when it's slanted down all the way, pointing directly at the ground, as opposed to when it's slanted out toward the horizon, when it's tilted out toward the horizon, then it's half of a dipole, 35 ohms, if you know what I mean. So you go from 35 to 50 by tilting them down, and you're starting to go toward dipole, but that's not necessarily making them hot. You're tuning the radiator itself in that case, but you start changing the length of the ground plane radials, you're now going to make your ground plane RF hot. K2UPS, you're allowed to ask more questions on this, Rich. K2UPS, mobile, K2RIW in the TechNet.
No, I'm good on it now, I think. At first glance, it would have made sense to me to try that, but after hearing your explanation of it, the quarter wave ground plane, like I was talking about, the SO239 is really a completely different animal than a collinear, a dual band, like the other gentleman has. So, no problem, and continue on. Thank you. KTUPS.
And now to repeat this one more time, when you tilt the radials on a ground plane antenna, up, down, or whatever, slanting the radials, you're still having a ground plane or counterpoise that's not RF hot. You're allowed to do that to tune the resistive component of impedance, and it's going to have a slight effect on the reactant. So that's perfectly legal. But if you start changing the length of the radials, there's now a chance you're making the ground plane no longer a perfect counterpoise. You would like the base of the antenna to see a short circuit on the outside of the coax cable to the universe, and making the radials a quarter wavelength long electronically, no matter where they're tilted, fulfills that requirement. So my recommendation is you don't change the length of the radials at first. That's the last resort, if you know what I mean, because of this RF hot situation. Let's see if Steve's got any further requests on what he was asking. Was it Steve's question? I think it was Steve's question. KC2MDP, for any final comments or questions, K2IW in the TechNet.
Okay, I thank you, Dick. I thank K2UPS. I thought of that, too. My only question is, do you suggest I should put a bound at the antenna? You were mentioning that before, that would take some of the RF off the cable. Do you suggest that? Or do you think it's overkill? And what should I get if I were to do this one-to-one?
First of all, tell me once again, what is the actual antenna, Steve? Go ahead.
Okay, it's Diamond, I think it's X700. Basically, it's a collinear, you know, fiberglass. And, yeah, it's got the three little 18-inch, ground radios on it. And, basically, it's just got a, you know, a regular end connector set at the bottom.
And that Diamond antenna, am I correct in assuming it works on both 2 meters and 450, Steve?
That is correct, yes.
Under normal circumstances, that antenna does not require a balancer. If you were going to start using the ground plane radials by changing their length as a tuning device, which you're making the ground plane reactive, which now it would have some RF on it, and in that case you put an ideal balun at the base of the antenna, that would act as a kind of an RF choke, and it would stop the RF energy from crawling down the outside of the coax. So if you were using the ground plane radial length as a tuning device, then the balun is a possible solution. Other than that, those radials, if they're doing their job, they're presenting a short circuit at the base, and the balun is not going to buy you anything. That's my belief on that one, Steve. There's quite a few situations where guys will have a unbalanced-like antenna. If, for instance, I was using a quick and dirty dipole-like element for either my dipole as the radiator or the dipole as the driven element of a Yagi. And if I'm foolish enough to just take the coax cable, center conductor to one half of the dipole, shield to the other half, you've now got a really hot RF coax cable situation, because the dipole always wants to look like a balanced load. Each half of the dipole is really a separate antenna to the universe. Let me drop. And each one of those is a 35-ohm impedance, so to speak, to the universe. And the two of them are in series back-to-back. It looks like a 70-ohm. If it was a dipole all by itself in free space. But whenever you bring the shield of a transmission line directly to the driven element of a dipole-like antenna, you've got a hot situation. And the pure way to go about that is to put some kind of an RF choke on there, like a great big ferrite beads, a poor man's balun by way of a few turns of coax held together with a black tape, or to use a one-to-one balun in that case, would stop the RF energy from crawling down the outside of the coax. There's all kinds of ways of making a balun-like device for feeding the driven element of a coax, of a dipole-like antenna. A gamma match is one way that does a medium good job, for instance. And I guess the J-pole is another technique. A J-pole antenna really has a kind of a built-in balun. A gamma match on a dipole is a kind of a built-in balun. But under normal circumstances, shield of the coax going to one half of the active portion of a dipole is not recommended. It works, but you're gonna have some problems. So the balun itself in that case, when you do add a balun, acts like a isolation transformer. Anybody with
W2HWW?
Okay, sounds like Howie's got some information on this one. Go ahead, Howie.
Okay, I'm on Echo Lake. Chick, what about a quarter-way piece of cable? I think 100 ohms or whatever it would be, building a matching transformer, a quarter-way cable of different impedance. You would have to do the math, go from the 70 ohms to the antenna, because you can't change the length of the antenna. That's inside of a casing, inside of plastic, plus with multiple elements. But what about a piece of quarter wave transmission line at a particular impedance? The only problem is that it's too bad. So maybe you could have two cables in parallel, and you could do it that way for the quarter wave.
If I understand you correctly, Howie, using a quarter wave matching transformer, in other words, a quarter wave length of cable of some chosen impedance, in order to correct the impedance, the resistive component of your antenna. Can it correct the resistive component? Absolutely. And if you're really smart and you use the right impedance of cable and you make it a little bit longer or a little bit shorter than quarter wavelength, can you also correct some of the reactive components of your antenna? Yes, but there's a catch. A quarter wave matching transmission.